You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Marcela Diaz. She is executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, and we're here to talk about the news on wage theft and other issues facing immigrants right now in Santa Fe in New Mexico. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Always great to be on your show.
So one of the things that has happened recently is that there's been a settlement regarding the issue of wage theft. First of all, what does wage theft look like here in Santa Fe, here in New Mexico? What is the scope of the problem?
Well, wage theft is the underpayment of wages, non-payment of wages, non-payment of overtime. It manifests itself in so many different ways. Sometimes people are required to work off the clock, finish a hotel room, for instance. We get a lot of complaints, you know, clock out at 4 o'clock, but you have to go back and finish the last hotel room that you were cleaning. That's something that's very common here in Santa Fe, in our tourism economy. It may be 15 minutes at a time, 20 minutes at a time, but over the course of a few years working at a hotel, that's, you know, thousands of dollars. And if you multiply that by all of the housekeepers, it really can make an impact on those families and the local economy. And in reality, it also can impact and put at a disadvantage the businesses that are actually following the rules. And we like to say always that most of businesses are following the rules. But wage theft can have a tremendous impact on families, especially low-wage workers who are living paycheck to paycheck. And so we can see families quickly propelled into poverty, having to figure out how they're going to pay for a car payment, utilities, their house payment, or their rent. I mean, just imagine if you live paycheck to paycheck, Mary Charlotte, and you need, you're counting on your paycheck to be able to make your bills at the end of the month, and then all of a sudden you don't get it. So it has a big impact on families, on workers, not just immigrant workers, but all workers throughout our state. And we've done a health impact assessment in McKinley County about the impact of not just wage theft, but other unchecked employment violations in rural communities on both Latino workers as well as Native American workers. And it's something that is really a difficult problem that we all need to grapple with. And so back in 2009, workers came together through Somos Un Pueblo Unido, reached out to many allies throughout our state, and we passed a really strong anti-wage theft law at the state legislature. We went from being one of the weakest states in the country when it came to deterrence and protections around wage theft issues to being a state with some of the strongest protections and deterrence. And so that was really exciting. And it was passed with a wide margin in the legislature in a bipartisan fashion. And it's in part because of the recognition of how important low-wage workers are to our local economies, but also a recognition that this is a really terrible thing. It puts a lot of hardships on working families when they're victims of wage theft.
And it turns out that even when you have really strong laws, a law is only as good as its enforcement.
That's absolutely right. We need to make enforcement of these basic working standards, right? Not just wage theft, but also discrimination laws, sexual harassment laws, health and safety laws. We really need to make it a priority because they're really impacting the bottom line for a lot of families. And they're also impacting the health of local communities and local economies. And so in 2011, we really saw a major shift with this administration in the way that the Department of Workforce Solutions, which is our state Department of Labor, was handling these cases. And so, you know, through much advocacy and community organizing around this issue, it sort of culminated in a lawsuit that we waged with some of our partners at the Center on Law and Poverty and other workers' rights organizations throughout the state to really push back against the State Department of Labor or the Department of Workforce Solutions for not enforcing many aspects of that 2009 law, among other things. And so we were happy in March to present a settlement to First Judicial District Court Judge David Thompson, who approved this agreement that we and these workers' rights organizations had worked out with the Department of Workforce Solutions that will ensure that our state government is actually carrying out its duty to enforce these strong anti-wage theft laws and hold employers accountable when they violate them.
So the settlement was won. What happens now to the workers who were not paid overtime or who were not paid their wages?
Well, there were so many things that were not happening correctly in the enforcement of the wage and hour laws. And so, you know, in 2009, we extended the statute of limitation from 1 year to 3 years to initiate a wage claim. And we also instituted as a deterrent treble damages rather than double damages. And some of those things were not being enforced. There were other problems. You know, people were being turned away for procedural or arbitrary reasons and not really able to file and go through the whole process of filing their complaints and recouping their wages. They also were turning away people who didn't speak English, right? And requiring people to do things in English and file their complaints in English. And so we pushed back against that. And the good thing is that all of those practices now are going to be vacated. And so we've been able to stop that. We're going to stop certain practices. So one of the other strange things that there was this cap of $10,000. And so a lot of our wage members of Somos Un Pueblo Unido throughout the state were being turned away because they were owed too much money by their employers.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And so it's easy for, you know, our city or for our state or for the Federal Department of Labor to say, well, why don't you just go with an attorney and go to court? The problem is we really, that can take months, if not years, to go through the court process. We need strong administrative procedures because it can be a swifter process. It can allow for more immediate negotiation and settlement between the parties. And so that's not just good for workers who are victims, but it's also good for employers because they don't have to drag it out, right? And so some of the things that we were able to gain through this settlement is that, you know, they're going to not have the cap. They're going to actually implement the 3-year statute of limitation plus continuing course. There's a continuing course of conduct provision within our law. And I think from what I understand, there are only 2 states in the country. So, you know, as long as your last violation happened within the last 3 years, and, you know, it's clear that this was conduct that was happening over a number of years, there really is no limitation to what you can try to recoup from stolen wages. So they're going to reopen those cases. Workers have until March of 2019, if their cases were closed arbitrarily or if they were turned away, to go back and reopen those cases. And so we're encouraging folks, if they're in that situation, to call Somos in Santa Fe or the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty in Albuquerque. And we, of course, organize in 8 counties. And so I have to say that we were able to get some of these things, but one of the things that we're really, really proud of, in addition to, you know, pushing the department to actually enforce the laws that we helped improve back in 2009, is, you know, that we have a lot of members in rural communities, and they don't have access to investigators or to the department's offices, the labor division. Labor Relations Division offices in Las Cruces, Santa Fe, and Albuquerque. But we do have Department of Workforce Connections offices that often handle sort of, you know, unemployment issues and job readiness. And so there are 26 of those throughout the state. And so now members will have an opportunity to go in, use their telephones, use their internet service to file complaints, their fax machines. They'll get more information in their language. We have guaranteed language and interpretation services now. So this is, it's a really important shift. And it's a message, I think, to all of our communities and, you know, to the city of Santa Fe, I hope, that enforcement should be a priority. And I can say that all of these gains, what really propelled this lawsuit were workers in our communities that were tired of getting the short end of this deal, and they really wanted to hold our local governments accountable and our state government accountable and ensure that we were sending a strong message out.
And I think it's really important for people to understand that this is, a lot of these folks are people who are minimum wage employees.
That's right.
And so overtime makes a really big difference. It makes the difference between being able to, as you say, pay your car payment or pay for a prescription or pay for a kid's medical bills or anything like that. I mean, the most basic things on life.
Yeah.
First of all. And second, that these wages are stolen.
Mm-hmm.
These are wages that were earned by law and not paid out.
That's right. And It's also, it's the short-term impact that you just mentioned, right? Being able to pay those bills, but it's also the medium and long-term impact on people's financial well-being and their investments. And so one of our lead plaintiffs is a member of Somos Gallup in McKinley County. His name is Jose Pancho Olivas. And he and his wife worked as employees to help this business open up a new restaurant in Farmington. And so they moved temporarily to Farmington, spent countless hours working and helping establish this restaurant. And their employer kept saying, I'll get you next time, or, you know, just think of me as a savings account. And they really trusted this employer. And they thought, by the end of this, we're going to walk out with thousands and thousands of dollars. And their intent was to go back to Gallup and start their own food truck business so that they could have something over. And Gallup, you know, it's got the highest unemployment rate. It's the poorest county, McKinley County, in our state. And so being able to start a business, being able to invest in that was something that they were looking for their family in the long term. And that went out the window when their employers decided not to pay them. So they were recruited by a bunch of immigrant workers who were a part of this campaign. And so this really is a worker-driven lawsuit.
What happened to that? Did they ever get paid?
So he, because he's a lead plaintiff, they're going to reopen his case and then investigate it the way they should have in the past. And he was actually turned away because he was owed $40,000. That's what he, and that's without damages. And so one of the things that the department now will do is actually when they come to a determination, they will, they weren't in the past, but now they will make sure that damages are a part of those judgments, damages and interest. So, you know, if you owe $100, you should try to pay it, because once it goes through this process, you'll end up owing, you know, interest on the $100 plus $200 more. That's the way trouble damages works. And so it's really important, I think, for employers to know that this is something that now we have a tight system at the state level. We're doing a lot of work along with the Department of Workforce Solutions that really did, in good faith, put together with us, really move forward with a really strong settlement. And there's a radio ads out in English and Spanish. You know, Somos Un Pueblo Unido, we have our own PSAs in Diné and in Spanish and in English in McKinley County. Because again, this isn't just impacting immigrant workers. It's really impacting all of us.
Meanwhile, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, has been serving what are called audit notices to a lot of businesses in Santa Fe, meaning that they have to produce records of their employees' immigration status. What's going on in Santa Fe would have been the results of this, both for employees and for the businesses?
And for families and our local economy. I mean, you know, in 2017, we saw an increase of 30% from the previous year of arrests and detention of immigrants in the interior of the United States. So this excludes the arrests and detentions at the border. And so this is not a surprise. Donald Trump, when he was running for president, said this was going to be a priority. In January, he issued an executive order, among many, basically saying that they were going to increase and prosecute to the hilt anyone who had additional potential criminal charges in relation to basically immigration, right? So document fraud, felony reentry. So if somebody goes and is formally deported and then comes back to the country, and this is a lot of us because we have deep ties and our families are here and, you know, our children and our jobs, and many of us own homes. And so if people come back to their communities and then get caught again, they end up getting slapped with a felony reentry charge, which means that they could go to prison. Federal prison, usually private, for a number of years. During that same year, 2017, ICE conducted 1,360 I-9 audits at businesses throughout the country in various industries. But late last year, ICE's Deputy Director Thomas Oman announced that they were really going to be focusing on this new strategy in 2018. It's not a new strategy, it's an old strategy, but they were going to heighten enforcement at places of employment and that they were going to increase I-9 audits by 400%. Well, come February, we saw it. California saw a number of I-9 inspections. And so for your listeners, you know, most of us who have been employed in, you know, within the last 30 years have had to fill out an I-9 document, right? So we have to have a proof of identity, and we have to have a proof of our legal ability to work in the country. And so if you're a U.S. citizen, it can be a passport or a social security card. If you're not a U.S. citizen, you can show a green card or one of the many, many, many different kinds of work permits or documents that show your ability to work in the country legally. And so when we get a new job, we have to fill out this paperwork. And then our employers generally have to keep them for 3 years. Many employers keep them for longer, even though they don't have to. Many employers make copies of all the documents, even though they don't have to. Really, it's hard for an employer to really, I mean, an employer obviously is not an expert on document, on, you know, and the various statuses of immigrants nor documents. And so, you know, employers can kind of get confused in this process very easily. Well, now the Trump administration is really increasing those I-9 inspections. So what happens when this happens? And we know that here there were at least 6 businesses, probably more, but there were about 70 or 63 from the last newspaper article that I read, I-9 inspections throughout the state of New Mexico within the last month. What happens? They come to your place of employment. It puts a lot of people on edge. Of course, a lot of people don't have status because we, you know, have a very outdated immigration system. And as you know, all of our efforts as a nation to improve and to change and fix our broken immigration laws and systems have proven futile at this point in Congress. But this is really upending local businesses, and it's really upending families because, again, these are workers, absolutely vital to local economies. Here in Santa Fe, most of these I-9 audits that took place at mom-and-pop shop places, restaurants, immigrant-owned, Latino-owned businesses. It really makes the employers uneasy because they have this information and they don't want to give it to ICE because it might mean not only the loss of their workers, but, you know, people develop relationships with their employees, and they know that they have families who are going to be impacted by a potential loss of job or deportation. And so they came in and they did a number of these audits. And so we jumped into action to make sure that workers knew their rights in this situation and that employers knew their rights. So we came together with, you know, some of the business associations, like the Home Builders, Santa Fe Home Builders Association, and the Green Chamber, to really help educate employers about their rights in this process. What can they do to protect their businesses, but also their workers, right? And so many employers don't know that they don't have to allow ICE to go into their private areas where back of the house workers are, for instance. Many don't know that they can, you know, request a judicial order in order to turn over these documents, that they can request extensions, that they don't have to turn over all this information. And the other thing that's really important for employers to know is that they don't have to create an opportunity for the ICE to come and interview their workers. And I know that that's happened in the past with some of our members in Farmington. I remember a lot of the oil and gas companies in Farmington a few years ago were getting audited by ICE for their I-9s. And so what they would do is they would tell their workers, come on this day and bring your new documents and everything will be fine. ICE just needs to see them. And of course, when they showed up, ICE arrested them and put them into deportation proceedings. So it's a loss of immediate income. It's a loss of a worker. And so there is a lot that employers can do, but also workers need to know their rights. One of the things that we're really demanding from the business community here, Mary Charlotte, in Santa Fe, is that they notify their workers immediately that ICE is doing these I-9 audits to give their workers an opportunity to decide how they're going to handle this, right? Whether or not they can, you know, workers have an opportunity to if there's a real discrepancy that they can resolve the discrepancy. But also if employees need to leave, if workers need to leave, it's really important that employers know that, you know, they should pay them their last paycheck at the next pay period. And if they end up having to fire workers because they don't have authorization, they have 5 days to pay them their last paycheck. And so, again, we've been doing a lot of workshops in the community around what your rights are as a worker in this situation. And also, we've been teaming up with immigration attorneys in the city of Santa Fe to help post information about what the minimum of responsibilities to comply that employers have. So we really have to come together as the community. What's also a little scary in this I-9 audits is that even if you don't work there anymore and your information is in the records of your employer, you may think, well, you know, I don't work there anymore. But when they give that information to ICE, your name and your address and the information that you use to obtain that job is there. So you may very well get a knock on your door at 6 a.m. with an arrest warrant by ICE. And so in those situations, we still have rights. We don't have to open our door. We don't have to talk to ICE. We can ask for an immigration attorney. You know, obviously we have to pay for it. But these are things that we're really trying to prepare our community for and come together with our allies here in Santa Fe to do.
Santa Fe is a sanctuary city. What does that really mean? Are there any protections for undocumented immigrants that they don't have in other places?
Absolutely. Our sanctuary policies really in Santa Fe are some of the strongest, if not the strongest in the country, both at the county level, at our local jail, for instance, and certainly at our city. And so people often don't understand what sanctuary is, and there really is no legal definition of what sanctuary is. We say sanctuary policies really are a range of policies that are protective in nature. So we're not going to share information. We're not going to inquire about immigration status as local governments or local police or local sheriff or local jails. But we're also, so we're going to keep that information private. We're not going to inquire. We're not going to proactively enforce or work with ICE to enforce immigration laws in our community. But we also think that, you know, the other side of that range is, you know, the integrative policies that we've passed as a community and as a state. We think the number one sanctuary policy that we have in the state of New Mexico is the provision of driver's licenses, regardless of immigration status. And so that, of course, is a criminalization of, you know, in other states where you don't, where you're not allowed to drive legally, and you're in a community like Atlanta, Georgia, for instance. There was a New York Times article in Atlanta, Georgia, that their arrests and detentions and deportations have skyrocketed in that region because, one, people are forced to drive illegally, and two, when they're stopped for routine, you know, seatbelt checks or DWI checkpoints or license and registration checkpoints, they immediately, because they don't have sanctuary policies, and in fact, they're preempted from passing sanctuary policies in the state of Georgia, they turn them over to ICE. And so that's why you've seen. That's what we don't have here in Santa Fe. And Santa Fe's not alone. We count about 24 jurisdictions that have policies on that range of protective, no inquiry, don't share information, to integrative policies like in-state tuition and financial aid. Now, Santa Fe has a really strong non-disclosure, privacy, and confidentiality policy that we passed with everyone's help in February of 2017. And so that's good. But one of the other things that that policy did was it laid out a whole series of things that the city would be doing along with partners in our community. So, you know, it's not allowing ICE on city property without a judicial warrant. It is ensuring that as a city, we are not engaged in E-Verify. And the federal government can't really force us to be engaged in E-Verify because we have certain rights as local municipalities and localities. But it's a real message to employers that the E-Verify program to verify people's authorization to work is fraught with problems. It is very, you know, there are a lot of bad hits on it. It does not update it with all of the changes in an individual person's immigration status.
You mean, so if somebody actually gets a green card, it doesn't get updated and that person might go into deportation?
Yeah, not quickly enough. Or they lose their jobs because they may not have had status at one point and then they got status and the system is not fast enough. And so if you have E-Verify, you may end up not hiring people that you could hire and discriminating against them because of their national origin, or you might feel like you have to fire someone even though they have the ability to work. So there are all of these false hits. There are so many problems that have been documented with E-Verify. And so I know at least one very large business here in town, and they had E-Verify because they thought they had to. And then when our resolution passed and it was clear that in the body of our resolution, we're pointing out the problems with E-Verify and we're saying our city is never going to voluntarily be a part of this program, even as a city, it really educated that very large business owner, and the business owner decided to stop using E-Verify. And so that's in part why we wanted to make sure that our city was doing the right thing. The other thing that the city is doing is it's working with its community partners. So when this I-9 issue came up, the city was quick to, you know, work with us and doing a press conference and to put information about workers' rights and employers' rights in this I-9 process on their website. You know, we have a whole group of stakeholders that meet and talk about these issues. So for us, even though sanctuary doesn't mean that ICE can't come in, because it's the federal government, they can do their job. And in fact, we've seen an uptick in enforcement at homes. And, you know, we've heard some really terrible things that we think border rights violations that we're going to be pursuing in the near future. We heard from one of our members who was leaving his house very early in the morning to warm up his car. And this is a good story. I like to share the good stories too. He saw that two agents were walking to him as he was outside turning his car on, and he got out of his car and he came, and there was a fence around his yard with a gate that could close. And they came up to him and he just quickly moved behind his fence, closed the door and locked it, but he could still see them. And they were very irritated by that. And they said, "Why are you closing your gate?" And he said, "Because I can, and this is my property." "Well, we're looking for this person." "I don't know that person." "Well, what's your name?" He told them their name. And he said, "I'm going to go back into my house now." And he went back into his house and they left. And so that could have come out in that situation, could have had many different outcomes, but he was very, very clear about what his rights were. And he understands that his property is his property, and unless they have a warrant to come onto his property, a search warrant, his property is his sanctuary. So these are the things that we really are helping our community understand. And for us, that's what a sanctuary community is, right? We may not be able to put a wall around our city to not let ICE in, but we can do everything we can to support each other, help each other, and get as much information out as possible.
There are a lot of serious consequences to the current federal immigration policy. Like, you know, we read about how in agricultural areas there's literally food going unharvested because the workers aren't there to harvest the food. What are some of the consequences of these types of actions in New Mexico, in Santa Fe?
Well, about 15% of Santa Fe is foreign born, but of course, we are a community that's much bigger than that because we're in mixed families. Many of us have U.S. citizen children. You know, I'm the daughter of immigrants. And so it's impacting a lot of people, not just the person who was literally born on the other side of the border. Clearly, what we know about the impact of immigrants in Santa Fe is that, you know, our city economy would fall apart overnight without immigrants. And in fact, these actions upend local businesses and make it difficult for people to do business as usual here in Santa Fe. And these are many, again, immigrant-owned businesses that have been able to provide jobs. And so I was just at a forum the other night discussing immigration, and one of our members stood up. Another person was saying, well, we have to determine as a community if we want to pay more taxes to pay for the increased social costs of having immigrants in our community. And our member quickly stood up and said, hey, I pay taxes. I pay for my kids' tuition. I pay income taxes, state income taxes, federal income taxes. I pay rent. And in that rent, there are taxes that are a part of that. I consume. I work. My family contributes just as much, if not more, than any social costs. And we are helping stimulate this economy and keeping this economy alive. And so I think that is definitely a reality. And so when you have these kinds of increased enforcement measures, it really does impact our economy. I mean, and that's just one way to look at it, obviously. We've lived here we've deep roots here. Our members have had deep roots here. And have children here and go to school here and are a part of not just the economic but the social fabric of our community. And so that's the kind of impact that these increased enforcement measures are having. They are really upending that. And so our city needs to continue to fight back. Now, at the state level, we organize in a lot of rural communities, and there's a new ice processing center in Roswell. Many of our members in eastern and southeastern New Mexico are oil and gas families. They're small business owners that are catering to other immigrants in these communities, and they're also work in agriculture, primarily the dairy industry. What many people don't know is that in the western states, 99% of the counties that are in the western states, so like, you know, Nevada, Arizona, that are rural, 99% of the rural counties, that it's immigrants or Latinos that are either increasing population in those rural communities when rural communities around the country are dying, or helping avert population loss. And that is absolutely the case in eastern and southeastern New Mexico. In the last 10 years, there has been an increase in Lee County, which is oil and gas country and dairy country. And the increase has been 100% Latinos, 100% immigrants in those communities that are opening up businesses, that are renting, that are working, that are paying taxes. Their kids in the school systems are providing jobs for social workers, counselors, teachers, administrators. And so these communities are relying on immigrants to stay alive. But many of these rural communities are also very precarious economically. And so any major shift or even slight shift in enforcement in these communities can really, if not decimate, certainly impact significantly these local economies. And that's what we like to remind our legislators, right? It's really easy for communities to say, and not in many of these communities are very conservative and anti-immigrant, but we're doing something about that. We're getting people out to vote. There are 8,000 people in these four counties in eastern and southeastern New Mexico that are eligible for citizenship but haven't registered yet, in part because they're living in rural communities where there isn't a strong legal infrastructure. But our members are on it. They're, you know, doing this major citizenship blitz so that people can register, become citizens and register to vote before the 2018 election. But these kinds of communities, when they have these enforcement activities, which we've seen an increase in, you see people not go out to eat, not go out to their Walmart to buy things, and not really operating the way they normally operate. And really, a lot of our, you know, we're a poor state, and in rural New Mexico, we cannot afford that kind of disruption.
And there's another piece to it as well, which is that, I mean, many more pieces to it. And one is that immigration, ICE has been going after people like waiting outside of courthouses. There have even been incidents in hospitals and other places that are considered safe. And that puts a damper on public safety because if people aren't using the court systems the way they're supposed to be used, but then also just like the lives, the feeling of terror that children have when they don't know whether their parents are going to come home, are going to be there when they come home from school. This was going on under previous presidents, too.
That's absolutely right.
What's different now? What's the same?
Well, we're seeing increases in enforcement activity. We're also seeing, you know, at the tail end of the Obama administration, it took a while for Obama to stop deporting en masse. I think when it became clear that no immigration reform was on the horizon with Congress and a real pushback against our communities, against the heightened deportations under the Obama administration, but also for administrative relief, which came in the form of DACA and DAPA, right, which was eventually both were ended, although DACA, I'll remind listeners, has been, you know, that the ending of DACA has not played out the way the Trump administration wanted because of the court stepping in. But we never saw DAPA, which was for the parents of undocumented immigrants who were also undocumented, relief for them. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing at the tail end of the Obama administration, one of the things that was changed, which now has been unchanged, was, you know, there was going to be a phase out of private prison contracts with the Federal Bureau of Prisons as well. And half of Federal Bureau of Prison prisoners under those contracts are immigrants for, again, things that are related to immigration, but that can be prosecuted as crimes. And so we've seen that change now. And of course, here in New Mexico, we have CoreCivic and Cibola in this multi-million-dollar contract with the Department of Homeland Security.
These are private prison contracts.
These are private prison contracts with DHS and then also with the Federal Bureau of Prisons to have both federal prisons as well as detention centers for immigrants. And that's what we have in Cibola with 1,200 beds. And so they have to fill those beds, right? And when they fill those beds, what do you see? You see the increased enforcement activities in Roswell and Clovis and Hobbs. You see increased enforcement activity in Rio Riba. And one of the things that I really want to stress with your listeners is that although we may have 22 different kinds of quote-unquote sanctuary policies on that range of sanctuary policies in New Mexico, our state cooperates with ICE, and it is really having an impact on public safety.
State police.
So the state police in northern New Mexico turning people over to ICE. We just got two more complaints from Rio Riba. Just, you know, people who were being, you know, they were supposedly being investigated by the state police, but they weren't arrested because they weren't committing any crimes, and they didn't have enough probable cause to arrest them on any crimes, but they just drove them, probably illegally because they were being detained illegally, drove them to the state police department here in Santa Fe and turned over to ICE that was there. So there's that. There's also something that has been happening for a number of years now, but we're seeing increased, because we're seeing increased enforcement activity in general, and they're going kind of going after everyone. We're seeing that cooperation manifest itself differently, and that's in the probation and parole department. So our state corrections department cooperates to the hilt with ICE, and so we have a lot of people who are just going to their regular probation appointment, and ICE is there to arrest them. In one case recently, a man was going to get his ankle bracelet, and he went and at the probation office that's not very far from Somos's office, and they put on the bracelet but told him, which I don't think is true based on the story of his family, we need a new charger and they're not ready until tomorrow. Come back at 10 a.m. tomorrow so that we can install the charger for your ankle bracelet. Showed up at 10 o'clock, didn't even... You know, there was no pretense of putting the charger in or anything. ICE was there the moment that he walked in. So basically, they were making an appointment with him for his deportation. And you're mucking up the system, and it's not the judicial system is not allowed to work. And when, you know, because people aren't opening their doors, if they are coming after a person with an immigration arrest warrant, they can figure out. Oftentimes, it's hard to figure out where people work, although we know that in the past, if they're looking for someone, they do searches on Facebook sometimes. And if it's clear on a Facebook page, for instance, where a person works, they will show up to the parking lot of that business. And then on their way out of work or on their way to work, they will stop them and arrest them. That has happened when people go to court for X, Y, or Z reason. Out in the, you know, they're not really allowed in the courts, or at least, you know, judges have said, we don't want you doing this here because it's not allowing people to access the judicial system in the same way as non-immigrants. On their way out to their car, they'll arrest them in the parking lot. In some cases here, and that has only happened once from what I understand within the last year. It was happening more at the beginning of 2017. But what was happening here in Santa Fe was they weren't even arresting them in the parking lot. They were following them in their cars outside of the parking lot and then just stopping them on the street. And so these, of course, are much more aggressive tactics than we saw in the past, and they're effective. That's why we're seeing an increase. That's why we saw a 30% increase in 2017 of arrests and detentions in the interior.
One of the things that I'm so struck by when I look at these policies is that for the life of me, I cannot find a single one of them having to do with immigration that has any chance of improving the economy. I mean, it seems based on a kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, but it seems like you're just hurting economies.
You're absolutely hurting our economy. And on the contrary, all of the studies have shown that if we were to actually legalize the 11 million people that are in the country as undocumented immigrants, that you would see major gains in the economy, both local and nationally. And so we're not only shooting ourselves in the foot for not passing coherent and sensible immigration reform, but the enforcement is also really harming local businesses. It's harming the agricultural industry. It's clearly harming families emotionally. And The other thing that I always like...
And it's really expensive.
And it's really expensive. And, you know, the Congress just passed a $1.3 trillion budget a couple days ago. And, you know, initially the Trump administration said it wasn't, you know, Trump wasn't going to sign it, but he did. And it was in part because he wasn't getting all the money that he wanted for his border. But it still, you know, is giving $1.6 million for this border wall. And a lot of that money is going to go to private companies, as we know, for-profit companies. And, you know, it's only 33 new miles of fencing to be built in Texas. But, you know, when you give more money to Border Patrol, to the Department of Homeland Security, it frees up money to do the things that are really harmful to our communities, which is the enforcement, right? One of the things that they did get in this last budget, which is really concerning, is an additional 6,350 beds for immigrant detainees. And that's on top of the 34,000 that is already there. So Trump didn't get a lot of what he wanted, right? It's interesting. Our two senators supported it, but our representatives did not. Ben Ray Lujan did not support this budget, voted against it, as well as Michelle Lujan Grisham. And neither did Steve Pierce, who, of course, you know, two of those are running for governor, but for very different reasons, right? So two of them said, you know, this is too much money to give to ICE that's already unaccountable. More bed space, more ICE prosecutors to prosecute more people for immigration-related crimes, more money for a border with no accountability. But then you have someone like Steve Pierce who said, you know, this doesn't go far enough, right? But, you know, we just have to keep pushing back. We have to keep pushing back. The more bed space there is, the more families are upended, the more children are going to have to live without their parent. But also, you know, we have to think about the economic impact that has, both in the short term for families, but also the long term. You know, when you feel safe in your community and you feel that the community that you have invested in, time, your work, buying a house, doing all the things that everyone else does, because we're not that much different from everyone else, right? If you think that your time here is precarious or that you may end up having to spend $10,000 to fight a deportation because you get wrapped up in this craziness and irrational enforcement drive, you know, that's money that you may not end up investing in education, training, a house,
that
a
food
business,
truck.
The food truck, right? And all of that is good for our local families and local economy. So it's the short term, but it's also the long term. And that's why we just need to get this problem fixed. And obviously, I say that knowing that it's not going to happen anywhere in the near future. But our movement is strong, we're resilient, and what we can't get done at the federal level, we are working really hard to get done at the local level.
I've had you on the air many times over the years, and I don't think there's been a single time that we've gotten together where we didn't talk about driver's licenses.
That's true.
So let's continue this fine tradition and talk about what's going on now, which is, just a little background, there was a law passed in 2003 signed by Governor Bill Richardson that allowed undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses. And the term undocumented is a little funny in this context because, of course, they did have to have documentation proving who they were and so on to get a New Mexico driver's license.
Right. We do say undocumented is a misnomer because we are some of the most documented people,
exactly.
Right? With our passport. I mean, we and our matricula consular and all of the different forms of documentation that we have.
Right. And so I don't think I've seen people trying to come up with other language for that. But in any case, that's been in place since 2003. And then it came under attack year after year after year. And finally, there was a quote unquote compromise, which was a two-tier system that had on the one tier a real ID license and on the other hand a driver authorization card. And the result of all of that is it's really hard for anybody to get a license, and many of us and many of our listeners have gone through this. A coalition of plaintiffs, and you are involved in this, has sued the Motor Vehicles Division. Tell us about that and where that case stands.
I want to remind folks that both Democrats and Republicans basically a couple years ago said no to this governor and said, we are not going to take driver's licenses away from immigrants and fashioned a two-tiered system. Now, we were sort of under the gun when it came to the Real ID Act, right? And even though the Real ID Act in no way, shape, or form disallows us, as is evidenced by the law we actually passed here in the state of New Mexico, it does not disallow immigrants from getting, you know, undocumented immigrants from getting licenses. It just says if you're going to give them licenses, we're not going to necessarily recognize them right now, although that still hasn't been implemented. And the last deadline at the end of 2017 got pushed back for another year, 2 years, right? And so we've always said, you know, you have half the states that are not implementing the Real ID Act. And so you can't really trigger those deadlines unless you want to have people not be able to fly, which is crazy. So everybody can still fly with their Real ID or non-Real ID license. But the legislature created a two-tiered system, one that would allow people who qualified under all the onerous requirements of the Real ID or who wanted a Real ID license, but then also have a second-tier license, which I like to call our first-tier license, which is a New Mexico license that, you know, does not require all of the onerous documents and coming back in and bringing all your residency documents back in and your birth certificate and your social security to get a Real ID. Now, one of the reasons why New Mexico pushed back and why so many states have pushed back against Real ID over the years is because of those onerous requirements. And those requirements are going to make it hard, not just for undocumented immigrants, but the elderly, Native Americans who don't necessarily have birth certificates, or people who have very complicated names where you have one document, have one name, and then it's spelled differently in another. That happens often in lots of different ethnic communities.
And also, for example, homemakers who don't have a lot of things under their names.
That's right.
Because they're in their husband's name.
Or people who get married and change their names. Recognizing that, knowing, plus all of the privacy issues and all the privacy concerns and people not wanting a national ID card via driver's license. So this is why there was such a pushback and continues to be a pushback against the Real ID Act. And so New Mexico lost its extension for the Real ID and so decided to create this two-tiered system so that those who could qualify and who wanted under those heightened requirements get a Real ID, go for it, and then the rest of us don't have to, including undocumented immigrants and documented immigrants. So it was a really smart law, right? Unfortunately, it has been horrifically mangled in the implementation process. Everyone knows it. Lots of newspaper articles have been written about it. Lots of television reports. You hear it from everyone under the sun. We hear it less from immigrants, but mostly from the elderly, from Native Americans, from the homeless. So we have a whole coalition.
From the former mayor of Santa Fe.
That's right, who's our lead plaintiff. And so, you know, a lot of people don't know that Somos Un Pueblo Unido has a legal arm. We have a staff attorney that does a lot of this work with us. And what's great about the litigation that we move forward is that it truly is from our community and driven by workers and immigrants and allies. And so we, along with the ACLU and our good friends at Friedman, Boyd, Hollander, Goldberg, Urias, and Ward, who've worked with us in the past, and the Center on Law and Poverty and the ACLU, we have filed a lawsuit against the department for denying non-Real ID licenses and non-Real ID ID cards to New Mexicans that are eligible for it. So there are two main issues, and one is that they are going beyond their scope of authority at MVD and Tax and Rev and requiring documents like a Social Security card to get a non-Real ID or a Social Security number or an ITIN to get a non-Real ID license, when the law very clearly it says that, you know, these are two different systems, and one requires it, obviously, under the Federal Real ID Act, and the other one at the state level does not.
And you can walk in with a copy of that law, and they won't.
Oh, no, it's been such a mess. And it's not that we haven't tried. You know, we've worked very closely with staff to really try to fix this, and with our coalition, and many legislators have weighed in because they're the ones getting phone calls. But in reality, it's not necessarily an issue with the law. It's the issue of the regulations not following the law. And then a really screwed up implementation process, lack of training. You get one information at one MVD and you get information, another information. But one of the other big issues for both immigrants and non-immigrants that are trying to get non-Real ID licenses and non-Real ID ID cards is that when they're denied, they're not being provided provided with a process through which they can actually appeal their denial. And so that's exactly what happened in the case of our good former mayor, who was denied a driver's authorization card, also known as a non-real ID driver's license. He was denied four times at the local MVD because he lost his Social Security card, even though a Social Security number is not required under the law for a non-real ID driver's license. You know, he needs his license to, you know, he carries around his grandchildren in that great little sports car that he drives around now that he's retired. He has a father who is in his late 80s who suffered a stroke, and he has to deal with a lot of those responsibilities, and he has to use his ID and he has to drive. And so it's a real hardship on him. And you don't know, you know, we established a hotline early on, how many stories we got. 90% of them not from immigrants, from the elderly saying, I don't have a birth certificate, or I lost my Social Security card. Now, I want to remind your listeners that all of those of us, citizens and non-citizens who have driver's authorization cards or non-real ID licenses, we're flying with them. So that has not been triggered yet. And we don't think it ever will be. But as of now, it's not been. So we can fly with it and we can use it for most federal purposes. But people are saying, I don't need that real ID license. And I can't, I've gone three times. And I remember talking to this one older woman who called from Albuquerque, and she said, I have a license, and I've been getting my license for, you know, 50 years. I've been renewing my license for 50 years through the mail, and I don't understand why I can't just get, I don't need that federal license. And I said, well, what do you do? Why do you need a license? I mean, I was just curious. And she says, the only place I drive is about 7 miles a day to go visit my grandchildren, and then 7 miles back. That's all. And I said, well, if you don't get your license, are you going to do it anyway? And she says, yes. So it reminds me a lot of immigrants who have to drive irrespective of their, you know, whether they get a license or not. So anyway, that's what's happening. And so we're really pushing back. And we have many, many plaintiffs across the state. And the Coalition to End Homelessness is one of the organizational plaintiffs, along with Somos. And it's in part because, you know, the homeless population is also very vulnerable in this situation because, you know, they should be able to have this access as the state legislature intended for, you know, not to have to bring in all these additional documents.
I mean, one of the ironies is a lot of homeless people live in their cars and drive them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
and you know, and what one of the other issues is that, you know, in a few places, like I think it's Bernalillo, you have to have an ID to vote. And you have to have a valid ID to vote.
They have voter ID in Bernalillo County?
I think it's Bernalillo or Albuquerque. That's what, the ACLU said. Yeah. And so they, you know, if your license, in David Casa's situation, he went and in those four times, in the midst of those four times where he just couldn't, and he brought all of his documentation for the non-real ID driver's license, his license expired. So, you know, we don't have a voter ID law here in Santa Fe, but if we did, he would not have been able to vote. Because his one government ID is expired. So this is a problem. And so we're hoping to be able to quickly fix it. And not many changes need to be made, but the changes that need to be made will greatly improve all of our access to non-real ID cards and non-real ID licenses so that we can keep our insurance up, so that we can keep registration up. I mean, this is not really a privilege. It's a necessity.
We've just got a moment or two left, but I wanted to ask you, I mean, we have a new mayor in Santa Fe. We've got an election coming up in November of 2018. We'll have a lot of new people we'll have a new governor. We'll have some new representatives, both state representatives and federal. What kinds of policies and initiatives would you like to see in Santa Fe, in New Mexico?
Well, in Santa Fe, clearly, we need to improve our wage enforcement at the city. That's something that our members are working really hard on. They went to almost every candidates forum to talk about how wage theft and how the non-payment of Santa Fe's minimum wage is impacting their families.
But that's on track now that you have this decision?
No, well, that's at the state level. That's not the city level.
Okay.
And so at the city level, remember that we have our own law at the city. And so our city of Santa Fe, you know, again, at the state level, you and I both said, Mary Charlotte, that you could have a strong law, but it's only as good as its agency's willingness to enforce it. And so we need more investigatory resources at the city. We need our city attorney's office and staff to either have much better training in employment law to really understand the intricacies of it and the case law behind it, or contract outside employment attorneys to conduct these investigations, to be able to hold hearings, to hold mediation sessions, to give employers and employees an opportunity to, you know, meet out some kind of a settlement so that they can move forward with their lives. We need to make sure that we're, you know, it's a retaliation against employees if they are trying to get their wages is illegal, but nobody's enforcing that. So if we add retaliation complaints, we want to make sure that our city prosecutor knows about that and that we're actually, you know, putting some teeth behind the actual law that we have. The thing is, the law is very strong at the city level. It's just that it's not being enforced as it should be. And so we really want to, you know, we think that there should be proactive inspections. And if people are repeat offenders, the city manager has the ability under current law at the city level to, you know, suspend people's business licenses into the compliance. We really need to show that Santa Fe is serious about this. And so, you know, and there are many things that Santa Fe is, you know, some of it that we're doing very well, and in other places there's much room for improvement. So we're really hoping that with a new administration, we can see, and some new counselors, that we can really see that pushed through. And so that's what we're thinking of here at the city level. I can tell you that one of the other big issues that our members are really facing right now is just not having access to guaranteed sick leave. And so we know that there are many ways to do this, but the truth is people are having a really hard time because they are not being guaranteed sick leave, and they're showing up to work sick. And that is really impacting their health and the health of their families and their children. And it's also impacting the businesses that they're working in. And so there are things that we need to really get in front of. And so that's what we're really going to be pushing.
Yeah, we really want sick workers in a restaurant.
Right.
Preparing food, or in a hospital, or even on a construction site where you could make mistakes.
That's right. And people are getting, and a lot of our hotel workers that are a part of Somos, you know, they don't get guaranteed sick time in most of the hotels. We don't function as a city without hotel workers and restaurant workers and construction workers. And so we really need to be mindful about the health of everyone in our city, especially those that are making it work. So there's a lot of work that we're doing as a worker center here in Santa Fe. Well, we are a statewide organization, and we're doing that in many places. You know, in McKinley in the southeast, we're organizing dairy workers. We have a big Viva el Voto program in southeastern New Mexico and McKinley to get people out to vote. We're at the state level, and this is what really people need to be paying attention to in this next election. There are two major things. One, we need to take some of these policies that have been pioneered in northern New Mexico, San Miguel, Taos, Rio Arriba, Española, Santa Fe County, and these are these sanctuary policies, and we need to make sure that at the state level, we are abiding by them as well, so that the state police are not turning people over, so that, so that the corrections department, that the probation, because there's so much we can do. There's only so much we can do at the local level when you have a whole other state agency that is making it difficult and that's making people afraid of all law enforcement, including the law enforcement that doesn't cooperate with ICE, right? And so we have to have a much better policy at the state level that actually makes sense for our whole state. And I would be remiss if I didn't say we really need to be pushing back against these private prison contracts with our local communities and with ICE and Federal Bureau of Prisons that are not just impacting immigrants and immigrants' families and increasing. You see the immediate increase with these contracts of ICE enforcement activities, again, to fill those bed spaces. But our rural communities, our local communities, they need to find other forms of economic development in this, and not on the backs of our families and these precarious economies that we have, particularly in rural communities. We need to make sure that we are not increasing these contracts, and we need to start regulating them, because in reality, these private prison companies are human rights abusers. I mean, they have been demonstrated time and time again. And so we need to figure out a way to not allow the desperation of these rural economies to impact all of these immigrant families and their lives, but also the local economies that depend on them.
Marcela Diaz is executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido. And if you have any questions, ladies and gentlemen, whatsoever, you can contact them through their website, somosunpueblounido.org. And I will link to that at radiocafe.org. And if you haven't checked out the website, radiocafe.org, please do. This program on the Santa Fe New Mexican and some other programs too are on there. Marcela, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.